Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abual-Samad from Navigant Research.
And I'm George Kennedy from the Boston Globe and Car Gurus.
All right, well, welcome, George. You are automotive bon vivant and all-around
world. Ooh, Dan with the big words.
Don't waste good words on me. Just come on.
Those are not the best words. Don't worry.
But they're so, French, so I like that.
Yeah. So we're just gonna jump right into the cars. So this week, Sam, you drove a couple of cars. The Veloster N is what I'm really interested in, but you had also the Honda Civic Touring. So it sounds like it's been kind of a sporty time for you.
Yeah, well, the Civic Touring, you know, I've driven multiple Civics before, including the one that resides in our garage on a daily basis. And we have a 2017 Civic hatchback, EX hatchback. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the current generation Civic, the 10th generation Civic. It is such a huge jump over the prior couple of generations. Not everybody likes the design. Personally, I'm fine with it. I like it. And my wife certainly likes the hatchback, which is why we bought it. And the Touring, you know, the Civic Touring is the premium trim level of the Civic lineup, aside from the Type R. The one I was driving was the sedan with the 1.5 liter turbo and the CVT, which, you know, is a nice combination. It's a great engine. The CVT is one of the better ones out there, I think. And, you know, it's got great driving dynamics. And one of the nice things starting with the 2019 models is they finally replaced the replaced the head unit that was in there when it launched in 2016. So it no longer has the capacitive touch buttons for the volume and tuning and so on. They've now got actual physical volume knob.
That's good because the capacitive touch one sucked.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask if the one that you guys own personally, if it has a volume knob.
It does not have a volume knob, but it does have the volume rocker on the steering wheel spoke, on the left spoke of the steering wheel. So that's that's what we typically use, is the one on the steering wheel spoke.
So you get to control the volume. That's also
yes.
Nice.
Yeah. it's my wife's car. I mean, she's the one that primarily drives it.
I'll be a little more, you know, open about it. The driver gets to control the volume.
Yes,
correct.
Yeah. And, you know, in the Touring, you get leather seating and leather covered steering wheel and all that stuff, which is nice. You know, ours is an EX, so it has the cloth seating, which is also really nice. You know, it's comfortable and grippy. The leather seats are great. Honda always makes really comfortable seats, really supportive seats, which, you know, I've always liked. It's just a generally fun car to drive. And, you know, it's fuel efficient, too.
Yeah, and that's why I say it's been sporty, you know? And there's no big wing on the back. There's
no,
you know.
Now, you know, if you could just drop a Type R engine into that, now you'd be talking.
You probably could.
It's funny because that's, like, not outside of the realm of possibility, considering, like, past versions of the Accord Coupe with the 6-speed manual and the V6. Like, it's been done in the past where they've done high feature engines in kind of comfortable trims. I like this trim because when you talk about, like, what's affordable for people these days, I mean, what, this is like a $25,000 car.
Yeah, this one is pretty much loaded with just about everything available. It came to like 28 and change.
Okay. The one we have
was 24.
Right.
You can get a really nicely equipped one for 24, 25 grand. You know, like ours, you know, that was 24,000. It has a sunroof. It has the driver assist package, you know, with adaptive cruise control and lane keeping assist and all that stuff. So, you know, for even for that $24,000-$25,000 price, you know, basically if you can live without the leather seating and a few other premium trim options, yeah, 25 is absolutely doable.
So the genius about that car is, you know, we talk about what's affordable, what's aspirational. If you're a young professional looking for a first car, it's, you know, the Civic is so good in this space and that it's so spacious for a compact car. It almost sort of, breaks the definition of a compact because it's that, I don't know if you felt it was that spacious inside, but like if you're somebody who's looking for reliable, comfortable daily transportation, there's no incentive for you, unless you have kids that need a, you know, you need the backseat, to go upmarket to the Accord. The Civic in a well-optioned trim like this should suffice.
Right. And, you know, that's something we've talked about before and I've written about in the past is that, you know, over time, you know, all, you know, pretty much any nameplate you can find, you know, with each succeeding generation usually gets bigger, you know. So a Civic today, you know, is larger than an Accord was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Absolutely.
And even the Fit today, even going back to the first generation Fit a decade ago, was larger than the first generation Accord was 20 or 30 years ago or 40 years ago, whenever it came out, 40 years ago.
40 years ago.
Yeah. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, even a Fit, you know, is actually a shockingly roomy car for four adults because of the way it's
fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it remains my favorite small car. You know, it's the one that I always, when somebody is looking for a small car, you know, like a B segment car, the Fit is always the one I recommend.
Right. And what's funny is like, I do this, I'm sure you guys do the same thing when family members or friends try and ask you for car advice. You do this like choose your own adventure. First of all, you don't say that car is terrible because if they're asking your opinion, it means they probably already bought it.
They bought it. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But when it comes to like the Fit, so I do this like choose your own adventure. I'm like, okay, I'm in New England. There's a 99% chance they actually got a Crosstrek or a Forester. So let's figure out if they did that. If they didn't do that, what's the next most usable vehicle? And that's the Fit.
Mm-hmm. And then some people absolutely just don't listen anyway. They, you know.
Oh God, yeah. I mean,
I was telling someone like, oh, if you like sort of quirky cars, hatchbacks, I recommended the Toyota CHR to someone, and then next time they mentioned,
why it, would you do that?
Because it's fine.
Because he knows that nobody's going to listen to his suggestions anyway.
That is true. As you said,
when people ask, they're more often than not they're looking for affirmation of what they've already decided.
Right.
This
is like the Seinfeld where they're looking across the street at the lady like tanning herself, and Elaine's like, "Yeah, I'm that got in the space shuttle. I'm going to Mars. Okay, pack a good bag." Like, yeah. No one's listening to Dan.
This is my lament. The answer I got back was like, "Well, what did you get? I got a Mini."
That's a good point, though. Because, like, right, think about, like, what's quirky versus what's, like, feigned quirky. And, like, the Mini covers a lot of those bases. The CHR is funny because the CHR was, if I'm not mistaken, was supposed to be a Scion before they folded that up.
When they originally showed it as a concept, it was in fact a Scion.
Right. But what's cool about that car is like, and I know I just bagged on it, but like it corners and it brakes really well. Right.
This is what I was saying. Like it drives
zero muscle.
It drives surprisingly, and not just pleasant. It's like surprisingly satisfying. It has no power and it has a CVT.
It's like a modern MG.
It's fine, and so I liked it's got some little things to delight your design sense, and other than that, it's a Toyota, so you know it's not.
I'm trying to think back. We did a Car Gurus video on it like last fall, and there were some things I bagged on it. Like I feel like they may have done some very Mitsubishi-ish interior things.
Interior is not good. Yeah, I mean, it's
like okay. The controls. Like you guys want to talk about like haptic and not haptic? Like there were some things they were doing that are not good, and it's in desperate need of a interior refresh.
Well, Toyota's going to fix all that stuff when they roll out. What is it? Is it a CarPlay or Android Auto they're rolling out?
Avalon, Camry, Tacoma all have CarPlay as of this year, I think, right?
Yeah, and actually some of them also have Android Auto now. They're increasingly adding Android Auto to the 2020 models.
I have a funny story about CarPlay, which I will hold for a little while because I also want to know, now that you've done the sort of economy car thing, although the Civic Touring always feels a little sporty. Every Honda has that, like, it's got a little sport bike in it somewhere.
Yeah. Well, and particularly the current generation have more of that. You know, they seem to have lost that for a while, but they got it back with the current generation.
Yeah. So how does it, well, I guess it doesn't really need to stack up, but so you stepped out of that and you got in the Veloster N, which is getting raves from everyone. I haven't driven it yet. But what's your take on that?
I like it a lot. You know, it's been described in some places as the poor man's Type R, which, you know, to some degree it is.
That's not too far off. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I really like the current generation Veloster, and the N is the first of these N branded performance models from Hyundai. And they're going to be adding a bunch more on some of the other model lines over the next couple of years. So, you know, the N branding for Hyundai, in this case means you get a 2-liter turbo with 250 horsepower or 275 if you get the performance package. It remains front wheel drive. It's got dynamically adjustable dampers. There's an electronic limited slip differential on the front. It actually has pretty decent steering feel, which is surprising.
That's surprising in a Hyundai too.
For a Hyundai, right?
Yeah, that was always the thing where they'd have like they'd be 97% there, and you're just like all the pieces are here. The powertrain's good, but it just the steering's numb and the controls don't work together as harmoniously as they should. So that sounds like that's
on the Veloster end that it all works together really well. From a design perspective, you know, if you like that sort of mini shooting brake style, you know, it works well and it's actually practical. You know, the back seat is, you know, you can actually have a couple of adults in there, although it is awkward for the person who's going to sit behind the driver because it's a 3-door.
It still has a crazy door set up. Yeah.
It has the crazy door set up, which means you got to slide all the way across over, and it's set up as a 4-seater, so there's fixed cup holders in between the two rear seats, so you got to slide over the little hump and holders, but it's not so bad.
They should have gone like Scion IQ with it, with the offset seats, right?
Yeah,
I can't believe I'm invoking the Scion IQ for anything.
Really? The Scion IQ, which is pronounced ick, by the way.
Oh, I'm not doing that. But
yeah, I drove the Veloster N from my home near Ann Arbor to Pittsburgh last weekend to speak at a conference and then drove back again. And, you know, so put about 600 miles on this thing. And, you know, it was a lot of fun to drive. And, you know, it's got multiple different drive modes, you know, so you got normal and eco. When you're driving, for going on a long highway drive, I just kept it in either normal or eco mode because there's also a multi-mode exhaust system on there. When you put it in sport or in N mode, it gets considerably louder, which, you know, if you're going to be behind the wheel for, you know, 4 or 5 hours, you probably don't want to be dealing with that the whole way. But, you know, once it's time to have some fun, you know, when you put it in N mode, you know, you get some of that, you know, the little backfire, you know, when you're shifting, you know, it sounds fun and it is really fun to drive. You know, you can also feel a distinct difference especially in the suspension when you switch it over to N mode. The dampers get substantially firmer. There's some speed bumps in my neighborhood here, and when you drive over them in normal mode, it's fine. It's quite acceptable. The ride quality is good, even though, you know, it's on these skinny little, you know, tires, you know, with about a quarter of an inch of sidewall. But then as soon as you put it into N mode, you know, it becomes like a rock. You know, I mean, it'd be great, you know, if you're on a smooth, curvy road, but, you know, if you're hitting bumps, not so much.
Well, you're supposed to slow down.
Yeah.
Come on, Dan. I just love to hear that they actually have like really discernible modes, because there are a lot of cars that
they give you modes, but there's not really any difference.
Yeah, exactly.
You actually feel the difference.
So I do have two questions. Yeah. One, was this car Robin's Egg Blue?
It has the sort of evocative Gulf livery.
For sure. And two, just to use the analogy, for M, because I'm still trying to get a read on like what N is gonna mean for Hyundai. Is this like M235i or M2 as opposed to the rest of the 2 series?
I would say more M235i.
Okay, and I think that's as far as we're gonna go, given what they are.
Yeah, I mean, for that brand, I mean, someday, who knows, maybe they'll do something that's more M2. But I don't, you know, I don't think the brand is quite ready for that yet. But, you know, that performance blue color, that pale blue color that you mentioned, you know, that is the signature color for the N brand. And so when you get any of the N brand or any of the N models, you know, you'll have things like matching seat belts in that same color. So regardless of what the exterior color is, you'll get those blue seat belts. There's blue accents in the interior, you know, and it looks pretty cool. You know, blue contrast stitching on the steering wheel, and the mode buttons on the steering wheel are also in that same shade of blue. So
I am a sucker for those things. Like those, something like that, where you're just differentiating it. Like, you know, if you're picking a color or you're doing like little accent things, I'm just a stupid sucker for those things. I hate that I am, but it exists.
No, the detailing is really nice. I'm looking at it now on the website, and that's the thing that stands out, is just how thoughtfully they've made it feel special, because it is a special model. And so, you know, like I think that's warranted. Did the one you drove, they're available in manual. Did you have a manual?
Oh, yes, it was a manual. Yeah. And it has there's you can switch on rev matching in there, which works really well. What else? Oh, the couple of details that about it. You know, the interior materials are all hard plastics. There's no soft touch materials in there, which, you know, some people might not care for, but you know, you also got to keep in mind that this thing starts at 27.4, which is a good $10,000 less than a Type R. You know, it's not quite as quick as a Type R, but it's pretty damn close. And you know, for $10,000, I could live with the hard plastics. The only other thing that was kind of a pain for me, the seats, you know, they're manually adjustable seats, and they're limited pretty much to just height, fore aft, and seat back angle. So there's no lumbar adjustment. And after like 4.5 hours in the car, you know, I could have used a little bit more lumbar support, but you know, that's just me. It's the shape of my back, I guess. You know, most people would probably be fine with it. Other than that, the rest of it is great. You know, and I like that, you know, the design things that they did with it, like the spoiler on top of the rear hatch, is a lot more subtle than a Type R spoiler. But, you know, the things that they've done, you know, like the red accents on the rocker panels and on the front fascia.
I love that.
It's really cool. Yeah.
Well, the nice thing is at least it can, you know, deliver on the image of that, as opposed to like, hey, I got a Subaru Forester Turbo Sport thing that has the same little pinstriping. It still has the little, you know, whatever engine. I drove the turbo last fall. And what's interesting is I think, you know, you mentioned the manual seats. I think that's a bit of a decontenting compared to some of the other trims, if I'm not mistaken. Like, you can get the power seats.
I think so, too. Yeah, I think on the, like, if you get the regular Veloster, like the Ultimate trim.
Right.
And you do get some of those things. So I think, you know, they're focused here, you know, on trying to provide the most performance, the most bang for the buck.
The GT2 RS method, take everything off and add more to the price.
And then charge you more to put it back in.
Yeah. Well, so what's funny is, like, if you take all that stuff away and you look at, like, a Turbo Ultimate, like you described, that's compared to the Gen 1 Veloster to this, it's the same silhouette, but it's a far more conventional car in a lot of very subtle ways. So if you look at the center console of the Gen 1, it looks like a Mini Cooper, like a candy machine level center console. This looks like it could be the center console on a Sonata. And a lot of the controls are more conventional. They realized, like, okay, we can make an unconventional car without everything being weird, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's probably cheaper.
It's unconventional, but still very usable.
Right, absolutely. It's an unconventional platform or silhouette or formula, but the day-to-day usability things have become far more mainstream, and I'm always in favor of that.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at the prices here. So the Veloster Turbo Ultimate actually starts at a little over 28,000. So the N is cheaper than the Turbo Ultimate. So it's, you know, it's a relative bargain performance machine.
So,
and there's no torque steer.
Okay. So Veloster N versus our benchmark GTI. How does it shake out?
Ooh, right.
Yeah, I think the GTI is probably going to be more expensive.
Yeah, not much.
Yeah, I think the Veloster N is going to be quicker, but the GTI is going to have a nicer interior.
Right, and it's more conventional. I feel like the Veloster with like Hyundai looked at that and go, wait a minute, they have a quirky offbeat car, but they're using an extremely proven conventional platform to do it. Let's go a little bit more mainstream again.
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, if what you want is something that has a little more premium feel to it, then actually the GTI starts at 27.6. So it's almost exactly the same starting price, but the GTI is going to have a more premium feeling cabin, but it's not going to be as quick. So if you want to get a little more performance, you know, at the expense of, you know, some of those materials, you go for the Veloster N. You know, and also, you know, if you want something that looks different, you know, the Golf GTI, for better or worse, looks like a Golf. You know, you will instantly recognize it as a Golf.
Right.
You know, and that's both good and bad. You know, there's that shape that's been there for, you know, almost 40 years now, and it will, you know, it'll continue to be there for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, at least so Hyundai can manage to maybe not box themselves into a box. They get like a, you know, high performance shoe instead. I don't know.
Well, what's funny about it is, from a styling standpoint and like the performance level, like it's less of a GTI cross shop, and maybe, you know, listeners or commenters could weigh in. Like, is it more of a WRX versus Veloster N cross shop?
Yeah, probably. I would say that's probably a better comparison.
Who do you see somebody vaping in first?
Listen, you don't want to vape. You just
brought to you by Monster Energy drink.
Right. Like, Jesus, you're gonna get us sued.
you can block all that out if you like.
Well, you know what? Like, I think it's actually sets up a really nice transition. Because while Sam was driving the Veloster N, I had the new Subaru Legacy, so the 2020 Legacy. And it's and I know you had it too, George. So it's I will say that overall, it's a really solid update. It feels really good to drive. It's great on the road. It's a really good size. It's the 2.5 liter FA engine, so it's not all that powerful. Works okay with the CVT, but it really, like, I was like, I could really go for a turbo here. Although the week before I had
offer.
Yeah, they do. And the week before I had an Ascent, and I felt like that was actually kind of jumpy and crappy and like less not
is crappy. That the same? Like, is the Subaru's engine, the Ascent engine, is the same as the high feature engine in the Legacy? Is that correct?
I think so. It's the 2.4 liter turbo. So it gets a little deeper, and it's, you know, it's got the turbo on it. But it just, like, the throttle response of that one felt like too much. So this one, while it's a little down on power, it's not exactly slow. It's just everything that's so friggin' fast. And it's fine. It gets 30 miles to the gallon. I had a really hard time actually getting the tank empty in it. I drove this
thing. And you tried. Well, what's funny is, like, you're right. So that is the base engine, and like, it's enough. And when you want to kick your heels into it, it gets there, but it makes a lot of noise.
Yeah, And you know, that's the thing is, Subaru like talks about, they're like, oh, it's smooth. And I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. You've got
who made a smooth boxer engine? Not you guys.
So the layout, it doesn't have the rocking or the vertical motion that an inline four is just going to have. There's no way you can like get around that.
Sure, but there are far different ways that people like reduce NVH that,
That's the weird thing. It's like they've got this inherently smoother engine that they make it like sound kind of funny, and they let all that noise come through the firewall,
which some people do on purpose, by the way. Yeah. When the new WRX came out and they had even rockers, people were going and modding them so that they had the uneven, so it would have that weird brr sound. Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? That's like basically the exhaust version of the people who leave or add exhaust the packing strips on their SRT chargers.
Right, and like it's fine. Like whatever you want.
Like the one down the block from my house.
Oh, is
it purple yet? Because the new ones are purple.
No, this one is like dark gray and black.
I mean the packing strips.
They're yellow.
So here's the crazy thing. So we heard that the new packing strips, not to go off subject, but the new packing strips are going to be purple. And no joke, I was in Newport last weekend for the Newport Concours d'Elegance, and I saw an SRT Challenger come down the main drag there, and you could see where it was originally yellow, and somebody like painted or taped over with purple. People are adding these things on after for cars that they don't belong to, and it's blowing my mind.
No, it's.
Hey, you know what? You own the car. Put whatever you want on it. Right. Who cares?
It's the backward, upside down, sideways visor.
Well, SRT even said that like the pebbles are going to get caught up underneath the tape and like actually scrape it.
Do you remember the 80s and early 90s when everybody was putting the?
No, I was four then.
God, you're not old enough. So back then, everybody would put
I was drunk then.
Everybody would put the bras on their car, right?
And everybody wore piano neckties. What's your point?
Yeah, so you'd get the like fake leather thing to cover the front of your 911 Super Carrera Targa, whatever.
Or your 924, yeah.
Right, your Coke machine. And the idea that it's going to protect the paint is actually backward, because you put this piece of vinyl there that traps water and heat and stuff underneath it. So it actually like causes damage to the paint and scratches it. And because the paint that's underneath it isn't getting the UV, guess what? All the paint on the car now sort of
misshapen, miscolored. Yeah. So I will say this, as a Jeep guy, I will have to cop to the fact that the automotive enthusiast community is a double-edged sword. I love that people care, but like misguided enthusiasm can lead to some weird stuff. And
really
I don't want to shame some folks, but it's like, same time, it's like, dude, there's a level of a modicum of restraint and taste that might go into any of this stuff. And
misguided enthusiasm is hardly unique to the automotive sector. I mean,
yes.
Look at
bad tattoos everywhere.
Yes.
At least you can take off the yellow strips.
Yeah. So back to the legacy.
Yeah. Oh, before you continue with that, one other note about, you mentioned the being able to run a long distance on a tank in the legacy. One issue with the Veloster, the gas tank is on the small side. It's only a 13-gallon tank. And so, you don't get that much range out of it.
Yeah. And it says it gets up to 29 miles per gallon highway. So it probably was getting like 24 for you.
I got about 27.
Oh, that's better than I thought it was going to be. Yeah. You have a lighter foot.
I was driving through Ohio and trying to avoid the Ohio State Troopers.
Yeah. You set the cruise and just relax. Yep.
Well, look, Dan, I don't have too much more time joining you guys. So I did want to touch on one thing about the legacy.
Go ahead.
So, all right. So a couple of quick things. I love the chassis dynamics. I think it handles really well. It's really practical. Like, it's more than just a four-door Outback. It's got a really big back seat, and it's got a decent sized trunk and all that stuff. The center console and the big portrait orientation 11.6 inch touchscreen.
That's what I was going to talk about too.
Let me just get through a couple things. One, if this was any other brand, I'd be like, fine, it's a sign of the times, but it's Subaru. And in my mind, as a New Englander, Subaru is like a pillar of pragmatism, practicality, the old ways or the good ways. Like, their interiors were drab as hell, and people loved them for it. They liked that they could beat on their interiors, and they're full of plastic, and you could throw applesauce at everything, you could wash it off. Like, that's good stuff, right? And even though it's a touchscreen, fine, whatever. It's, you got hard controls for the climate controls and radio. The only tactile controls.
But you don't have that's what you're saying. Like, now you
the
don't.
The old ones, ones, right. This new thing is a violation of what I interpret as like the core tenets of what makes a good Subaru. A Subaru is something that you can beat on and it will say, thank you, I will have some more. Right, from an interior.
Actually, it's a violation of core tenets that makes any vehicle a good vehicle. I don't know if you've heard, George, but I am the global leader of the ban the touchscreens from cars movement.
I'm not that far. I like tech when it's used well. I happen to think that the American automakers do a good job of saying some things are going to be touchscreens, some things are going to always stay as hard controls. So Ram 1500 notwithstanding, most of everything else is. Radio and nav and CarPlay is up in touch. But as our good friend Craig Fitzgerald always says, the 6 a.m. dark and cold controls. If you're going out to your garage and the light went out, can I use the radio and the climate controls and the heat, the defroster without looking. And those are all things that you should be able to hit.
Yeah.
The biggest sin of all of this touchscreen system is, so all cars have stop start systems, and anybody that reviews cars a lot of times, typically, unless they're John Volkler over at Green Car Reports, are canceling out the stop start system. So it doesn't, like, you know, auto cancel every time you go to idle.
I leave it running as well. I leave it.
Oh, you masochist. So,
here's the thing. And I think I this will come back to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I pair that stop start with the auto hold that everybody's doing now, but the legacy would shut auto hold off on every restart. So you'd have to go in and it's three steps or two steps.
Right. Wait, are we talking about the same thing? What's the difference between auto hold and stop start?
It's so stop start shuts the engine on and off. AVH, auto vehicle hold, actually keeps the brakes on.
When you're on a hill, when you apply the brakes and to take your foot off the brake pedal, it won't
roll back.
Till, yeah. Well,
but it's not even just on a hill. It's like at a stoplight. You just press the brakes. Yeah.
Wait, so turning that on turns off auto stop start. Did you just break my brain?
No. It keeps auto stop start on. You can set them individually, but it will hold, like, so you come up to a stoplight and you press it and the AVH comes on. You can then take your foot off the brake and just sit there and the car will hold itself on the brakes. And then it'll release the brakes when you hit the gas.
Here's the problem. So for a lot of cars, the stop start is pretty seamless because the engine themselves are smooth.
It is not in the legacy.
Exactly. So if you want to cancel that, in the past, in 99% of cars that have this, is just a button on the dash or a button next to the shifter, and you just hit it, done. This is two menus deep, okay? Yep. And not only that, if I want to change the temperature for the there's hard buttons for the temp, but if I want to change, like, the direction of the climate control.
Where it goes in the fan, there is no hard button.
It's three menu presses.
And okay? it comes up, and you gotta be quick. So, A, it comes up and you have to read it and figure out what it's doing, like what it's asking. Right. You have to find the thing to stab with your finger. Oh, you were too slow. Shut it back down. Now you're at the main screen.
Right,
again.
Right.
It timed out.
So in light of all these things that I'm bagging on about, there is one feature that Subaru does that I really like, and it's part of the EyeSight suite of driver assistance features. So I do like how Subaru makes EyeSight standard on almost every car they do. So you have, like, the 86, right? Or the BRZ, excuse me. One feature they have is the whole, if you are at a stoplight and the car in front of you pulls away and you don't respond, it gives you a little, like, blip. And look, you can't, like, change the behavior of human beings, all right? We're going to look at our phones. I'm sorry, okay? People are going to look at their phones or turn around and, like, deal with their kids that are fighting each other or look for that fry that fell in between the seats. For whatever reason, yes, I eat in the car. For whatever reason.
They're not your cars.
Right. yeah. So when the car in front of you bounces and goes ahead and you haven't responded, it'll beep at you after, like, a second. And that, like, kind of saves you from the angry horn honk behind you. And frankly, that's one of the most, like, realistic, like, real reality, like, self-aware features in any car today.
Yeah, all of that stuff is good. The EyeSight system was good. It was a little touchy, but you can also dial it back too. So, like, its default is a little bit more cautious. So it would beep at me and sort of do a little sort of tap of the brakes automatically, a little more than I thought was necessary. But then again, occasionally I drive aggressively.
What, you?
Yeah. But the... just the interface, that infotainment system is... the system itself isn't terrible. It's just they need more physical controls and they need to consider, like, where are the things you can access and how do you access them, and maybe consider, like, maybe don't make it timeout, maybe make it controllable. I fought with that for the whole week I had it, and it's a shame because the rest of the car is great. It's really,
the problem
really
is
good.
Too, in the past, if there was that system, I would just tell people to go get the base trim because it wouldn't have it. But I had to go look it up because there are no press images about it. The base trim, every trim of the base trim has this screen. In the base trim, it takes up the same real estate, and it's two screens. We're talking, like, Honda. Sam knows what I'm talking about. Double screen. Like, and I'm just like, oh, you guys are doing that with the base trim? Okay, we'll have fun with that.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, it's a solid update to the legacy. It's a really good car. You're just going to have that learning curve.
It's a really good car, and I hate to bag on some of these things,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Otherwise, yeah, it was solid. So if you like Subarus, it's gonna like tickle that, you know, that Subaru itch or whatever.
And it drives a lot better than some of the SUVs. Like, you almost forget after driving Foresters in a sense that like a Subaru sedan can be this refined in corners and in braking, yeah, and all that stuff.
The ride handling balance, the way everything sort of works together, the steering weight and torque is like, all of that stuff is perfect. The chassis guys get a gold star. And honestly, it looks good. It's easy to get in and out of. It's comfortable. Like all of that stuff that makes it a Subaru, that's all there. So they got some work to do on their new infotainment system. So
for sure. Well, look, I didn't do any of the homework on any of the topics that you guys are about to talk to in a bit. So I'm going to leave you now. Okay. I'm glad I got to yell about cars, and I'll check with you guys soon. All right.
Where do people find you? If they're looking for you, where do they find you?
Yeah, you can find our legacy review on Car Gurus. We're doing some other articles about car culture on Boston.com. And then I do some other car advice for U.S. News and World Report.
All right. Hey, thanks, George.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
It's been a very electric kind of few days. The Volvo XC40 Recharge came out, and that's sort of their first foray into a fully electric vehicle for Volvo, other than the Polestar.
It's the first Volvo branded production electric vehicle. They actually did something earlier in the decade. I think just in Europe only, they did some small number of V40 electrics.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But you know, it was never really a regular production model. But so this is the first regular production Volvo branded EV. And it's using the same platform as the Polestar 2. But you know, obviously a different form factor. You know, it looks like the XC40 that we're all familiar with, and it's got the battery under the floor like everybody else, and lots of other changes too.
Yeah. So and it introduces Recharge as Volvo's electric brand now. So anything fully electric from Volvo is going to have.
I think they're also using it on their plug-in hybrids.
Oh, are they? Okay.
I think it's anything with a plug is going to get branded as Recharge.
Oh, I get it now. Okay, I thought it was just the fully electrics. Okay. But did they basically put the XC40 top hat on top of a completely new architecture, or did they
no,
base the Polestar 2 off
it,
the?
It's a heavily modified version of the what is it there? I forget. The SLA is yes, their big right. one. I forget what the compact one is called, but it's a significantly modified version of their compact platform that is used for the XC40. Also the Lincoln Co. cars from Geely, as well as the Polestar 2.
Yeah, which I just a normal driving form. Like I thought that's a really good starting point, quite honestly. So I think that Volvo has always over the last 50 years, they've been kind of on the forefront of committing to environmental stewardship. And this is the next step for Volvo, I think, is they've figured out where they're going to take the brand now.
Yeah. And, you know, during the press event earlier this week, Håkan Samuelsson, the CEO, talked about getting to 50% EVs by 2025. Going forward, they're going to be introducing a new electric vehicle every year between now and 2025, and there will be plug-in versions of every vehicle that they offer going forward. So, you know, they already have plug-ins variants of many of their models, including, you know, all the 90 series models are all available as a plug-in hybrid. The 60s, the XC60, and I think the V60 are available as plug-ins. I'm not sure about the S60. So, you know, this is continuing the trend that they already started. And even the non-plug-in ones, from 2020 onwards, are going to have at least a 48-volt mild hybrid system as standard equipment. You know, so everything is going to be electrified to some degree or another.
Right. Well, that was sort of the thing that they came out and said not too long ago, that they had made that masterful release of information that was kind of already out there. It was like, yes, everything going forward is going to be electrified in some way. And people took it to mean like every Volvo is going to be an electric car, which is not
actually the reason why everybody took it that way is because the headline of that press release said that Volvo is going all electric.
Right. Yes.
That's what the press release actually said. All electric. It didn't say electrified. It said all electric, which was a complete misrepresentation of what they were actually doing.
I think it was in the PR world. That's obfuscation.
No, that's called a lie.
Okay, all right. I'm trying to give him a break because I like Volvo. But
you know,
when I
worked on the PR side, that was the sort of thing that, you know, I would very loudly complain about in editorial meetings, and whenever anybody tried to do something like that, I said, "You cannot say that. It's not true."
Yeah, that's fair.
Fortunately for me, I'm no longer in that position.
Right, and they continue to lie. So the details.
But that doesn't take away from the car, yeah.
Yeah, the car itself is. This is the thing that was the most interesting to me was like they didn't just make it sort of a mediocre electric powertrain. It's got 400 horsepower and even more torque, like 442 pound feet of torque. So this is probably the quickest XC40 you're ever going to see.
And, most likely, yeah.
It'll charge to 80% in about 40 minutes on a fast charger. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, it supports 50 kilowatt charging, same as the Audi e-tron.
And their WLTP number sounds really good.
It's okay. It's not great. Right.
Well, that's the thing. Like they get it to say 400 kilometers on the WLTP, which that, you know, 400. It is a nice round number, and that's what I mean. It just like it sounds good, but then when you convert it and you sort of lower your expectations for what it's going to be on the EPA, do you think this is going to come down to maybe just about 200 miles, right?
In terms, yeah, of it'll probably be right around 200, which is, you know, again similar. You know, the Audi e-tron, you know, is also rated at 400 on the WLTP, you know, and it's like 204 on the EPA. So it'll probably be somewhere right around there, you know, right around 200 or just a little bit more on the EPA cycle when it comes out next year.
So that's not, I mean, that's certainly plenty.
Although, you know, Volvo, you know, because this is a smaller vehicle, Volvo achieves that same range as the e-tron with a significantly smaller battery. They're doing it with a 78 kilowatt hour battery versus the 95 kilowatt hour unit in the Audi.
Oh, so it's less disappointing that it's getting that kind of range.
Yeah, I mean, it's more efficient. It is more efficient than the Audi, which you would expect it to be since it's smaller.
Yeah, well, and the Audi too. Like the thing about the Audi is that initial disappointment seems to have been tempered by the fact that like that performance is virtually guaranteed no matter what you're doing.
Yes, yeah, it's, you know, unlike a certain other EV company, you're actually highly likely to actually beat the EPA label numbers with the Audi e-tron as opposed to fall well short of them.
Yeah, and like that other EV company, the XC40 is going to be able to do over the air software updates and stuff. So they're yep, they're getting it set for a further sort of platform, sort of upping the tech from the kind of old line automaker that Volvo has been sort of a member of that class. And now we're seeing this shift where they're trying to do the things that others have done, but maybe less carefully. Everybody's getting into the act now. And so it's going to improve that sort of execution, I think.
Right. And like the Polestar 2, the XC40 is also getting the new Android Automotive powered infotainment system. So it's the same system that's going to be in the Polestar. So it's, you know, it's running Android underneath. It'll have a unique Volvo interface to it, but it'll have Google services in there. So you'll have Google Assistant for the voice recognition, Google Maps, access to the Google Play Store, you know, with availability of automotive related apps that you can download and run right on the system. So you don't have to use you don't have to have your phone plugged in to use the apps. What else? Oh yeah, so this is replacing, or you know, it's their next generation of their Sensus system. So it's a different interface from what's in Sensus today.
Which is, given Rebecca's troubles with it the last week, and, you know, you and I have complained about it endlessly. Yeah. I feel it's probably a good thing. Like we'll get to try it out and see how much we like it in practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to driving this one. You know, I like the standard XC40, and this should be an interesting change.
I think it's going to be even better as an EV because it's just going to have that sort of power delivery that EVs have, where it's just going to feel always ready, which mm-hmm. is nice, and it's going to be a little quieter. So it's just going to be the strong silent type.
Yeah.
So the next thing, we can sort of have EVs and alternative propulsion, other alternative propulsion technology fight each other. You wrote up the Toyota Mirai. You wrote it up for Forbes, just the introduction of the second generation of the Mirai fuel cell vehicle, which looks fantastic and shifts to rear wheel drive. So I'm all set. They can bring this tomorrow. I would be fine with that.
Yeah, so you know the original Mirai was it wasn't the first production fuel cell vehicle. You know, that was the Honda FCX Clarity, but over the course of about 4 years of production, I think Honda only made about 250 or so Clarities, whereas the Mirai was the first really volume production fuel cell vehicle, and they've sold about. I think to date, I think it's like about 9 or 10,000 of them globally, including Japan and here in the U.S. and in Europe. But the Mirai, unfortunately, was how shall I put this? It was ugly. It was just downright ugly, and frankly, it didn't drive very well either. You know, it drove a lot like previous generation Prius, which its platform was based on, which means that it was not very fun to drive. It was reasonably quick, but it was not very fun to drive. This new Mirai is on a new platform that is it's a rear wheel drive platform. It's also significantly larger than the current Mirai. This new one is about the same size as an Avalon, which makes it a big car, which means that it's unlikely to go down significantly in price from the I think $56,000 or $57,000 price point of the current Mirai. It's going to have substantial, like 30% more range to it. It already had pretty good range. It was already over a 300 mile range. So it should be approaching 400 miles of range and should be a lot more interesting to drive and certainly a lot more pleasant to look at than the old one.
So is it going to be, I know like in Southern California and out there, like this is not so much of an issue. You can have the fuel cell vehicle, you can fill up with hydrogen. Maybe it's a little harder to get, but it's there. I don't know that that's as easy up here in the Northeast. Now, I do see some Clarities, I think, from time to time. Those are the ones that have the wheels.
Those are going to be that's going to be the plug-in hybrid Clarity, not the fuel cell.
Okay.
The fuel cell Clarity is only available in California.
Right. Okay. I saw Clarity in traffic and I was like, how are they fueling that?
Yeah. Right now there's about 40 fuel hydrogen stations in California and that's it.
Yeah.
For publicly accessible stations. The Clarity is available in three versions, the fuel cell, a plug-in hybrid, and the battery electric version, which has a ridiculously short range of like 85 miles. the ones you're seeing are almost certainly the plug-in hybrids.
Yeah, that's what they've got to be. Again, though, the new Mirai, it does look good, and they went through all the time and trouble and expense to create this new version that seems like it's only going to work in like one small geographic area.
Well, they're supposed to start opening some hydrogen stations in the Northeast as well in the next year or so. So it by the time the Mirai arrives later next year, there should be it may well be available in the Northeast, in New England, and New York, and New Jersey, because they're supposed to open some infrastructure there.
That would be good because we have epic gridlock here. it might be nice to not contribute so much carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. It does make me wonder what drove those changes. Like, were customers asking for something that's more like an LS than like a Prius? It was a real surprise to see.
Well, from what I've been told, the original Mirai, it was originally intended to be a Lexus. It was supposed to be branded as a Lexus, not as a Toyota. And somewhere along the line, they changed their mind, decided to call it a Toyota. And, you know, mainly because of the pricing, you know, even as a Lexus, you know, I still don't think that the styling would have fit very well as a Lexus either.
Yeah.
You know, this time they decided to, you know, just make it a Toyota. It's probably going to almost certainly going to be, you know, a premium. You know, it'll be Toyota's flagship, you know, probably above the Avalon. And, you know, I think it's not necessarily clear, you know, who the target market is for this. You know, I think, you know, some, you know, I think anybody that is a big Tesla fan is probably not going to be interested in this. But, you know, there, I think that there are some people who like the idea of a fuel cell vehicle and like to have, you know, a big stylish, you know, premium sedan, you know, that happens to be electric and has significant range. So, you know, I think if you compare this to, you know, say something, you know, like the Lucid Air, you know, which is, you know, kind of a similar size, you know, that's a 400-mile EV that, or it's supposed to be a 400-mile EV that, you know, is going to start at $100,000. My guess is that this one will probably start, you know, in the low 50s, you know, so probably in the same price range as the current Mirai, but it'll be, it's a design that I think people will be much more inclined to pay $50,000 for than for the current generation car.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, dude, look at the current generation car. I'm kind of like, no dollars. No dollars will be exchanged for that. But it's also curious to me that the Toyota continues to invest in hydrogen. They're one of the few, I think, that it's really at least super visibly doing it. And so it's almost like they're hedging their bets.
Right now, it's mainly Toyota, Hyundai, and Honda and GM that are investing significantly in fuel cell technology. They are the primary ones, and BMW, you know, has a relationship with Toyota, and they have said that they're planning to introduce some fuel cell vehicles in the early 2020s based on Toyota's fuel cell technology.
So why that dichotomy? Like, everybody's moving towards EVs. EVs are sort of the talk of the town, but there's still
keep in mind that fuel cell vehicles are electric. They're not storing the energy in a battery. They're storing, you know, hydrogen is the energy carrier, and hydrogen going through a fuel cell mixing with oxygen is producing electricity and water. So the drivetrain, the powertrain for this is exactly the same as for any other EV. Yeah, it's got an electric motor. It's got power electronics. It even has a battery, but, you know, it's a smaller battery, like a hybrid size battery to do energy recovery, you know, to do regenerative braking, and, you know, to fill, you know, cut off some of the peaks.
Because
fuel cells work better, you know, in steady state mode than doing transients. So the battery helps with that. And, you know, for larger vehicles, you know, as you get into larger, heavier vehicles, fuel cells actually make a lot of sense, you know, because you can pack more energy into a smaller, lighter package than with a battery big enough to give you the kind of range you want with a bigger, heavier vehicle. So the larger the vehicle,
that's a really good point.
The more sense fuel cells make. And, you know, so in addition to the Mirai, you know, one of the things that Toyota has been working on over the last several years is fuel cell trucks. Heavy, you know, class 8 trucks. And they've been testing a couple of fuel cell powered Peterbilts, Kenworths, whichever, one of those, at the Port of Long Beach for a couple of years now. And they currently have a partnership with, I think it's Peterbilt, maybe it's Kenworth. I think they're the same company anyway.
I think they're a Packer, yeah.
Yeah, with them to build more of those trucks, to build a second generation of those trucks, and they're going to operate those in and around the Port of Long Beach and the Port of Los Angeles, and then Hyundai recently did a deal with Cummins, because Cummins has been working on some electric drivetrain technology for heavy duty trucks, for Class 8 trucks, and they showed something last year. And now they're partnering with Hyundai to also utilize Hyundai's fuel cell technology with their electric powertrain technology. So we're going to see Cummins and Hyundai powered fuel cell trucks as well. And then there's Nikola Motors, which is a startup that is doing fuel cell trucks. So when you get into those larger, heavier vehicles, fuel cells actually make a lot more sense, because you can get you know, the same amount of range with probably about a quarter of the mass of a battery that would be required for that kind of range.
Yeah, so, you know, they're going to maybe actually be successful where a certain other EV maker continues to release sketches and show off hacked up Kenworth semis.
They've got two mules. They've got at least two mules that have been running around, and I think periodically getting new paint jobs. which, you know, it sounds you know, if you're as old as I am, you probably remember there was another vehicle startup back in the 1970s and 80s that had a tendency to do the same thing. Vector Aeromotive.
Oh, it was Vector.
Yeah. I've talking to Don Sherman and others, you know, who were around in those days, you know, they Vector used to regularly show up at their offices, you know, with a prototype, you know, that had, it was the same prototype that they, you know, every 6 months or so they would repaint it a different color to make it seem like there was more than one car. And this went on for years.
I love it.
Yeah.
And would they change anything else in the car? Maybe
no, they just repainted it.
That's awesome.
And then, you know, this was in the days before they could do wraps, you know, which would have been a lot easier. They would just repaint it. And, you know, sometimes it'd be white, sometimes it'd be black, sometimes it'd be red or yellow. Then just trot it out again, you know, and, you know, try to raise some more money.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that guy was kind of a loon.
You could say that. We've talked in the past, you know, about Tesla, you know, and the fact that they seem to get longer range out of their batteries than anybody else. You know, there's a couple of factors there, some of which, you know, may have to do with, say, some shenanigans as far as how they do their testing, you know, doing their EPA label testing. But we're not going to get into that. But one factor that is absolutely true is that their drivetrains tend to be more efficient, more energy efficient than most of the other EV makers. And, you know, so even regardless of how they're actually doing their measurements, they are definitely getting more miles per kilowatt hour than almost anybody else. And one of the key differences in what Tesla does versus what everybody else is doing up until now has been the power electronics. So, you know, for those who, you know, aren't electrically inclined, batteries store electrical energy as direct current. And the output of a battery is always direct current. But DC motors are not as efficient as alternating current motors. AC motors are significantly more efficient than DC motors. And in an EV especially, efficiency is really important because the energy density of a battery is so poor relative to liquid fuels that it's important to get as many miles out of every kilowatt hour as you possibly can. And so they've used AC motors, you know, the two different types, either permanent magnet AC induction motors.
Right.
But to go from the battery to that AC motor, you have to go through some power electronics that switches that DC, that direct current, into alternating current. And the power electronics that are used by everybody but Tesla today use regular silicon chips. And the more power you put through them, they heat up a lot more. And, you know, there's limits on how fast they can switch, switching direction of the current. So what Tesla has been using on the Model 3, and I think now also on the S and the X, is silicon carbide chips in their power electronics, which gives them an advantage in terms of power conversion efficiency. Because when the chips heat up, that heat energy is coming, that's directly coming from the energy that's the electricity that's flowing through there. You know, if you're giving off heat, then that's less power that's coming out the other side of this power electronics module.
It's not going to the motor. It's not going to the motor. Yeah.
So silicon carbide chips can switch a lot faster and have a lot better thermal properties than just plain old silicon chips. And Bosch is currently building a new fab. You know, Bosch has been making chips for a long time. Most people don't realize that, but they're actually, you know, one of the bigger chip makers, semiconductor makers. They're building a new fab in Dresden right now in Germany. But at their existing fab, they are currently doing pilot production of silicon carbide chips. And the new Dresden fab, one of the things it's going to be producing is silicon carbide chips in high volumes. And that's going to be available for production in 2021. They're going to start delivering sample parts to automakers next year. And hopefully, you know, we start seeing them switch over to using silicon carbide in their power electronics fairly soon, because that'll help them get more range out of their batteries. And if you can get more range out of the battery, or you know, better energy efficiency there, then you can get the same range with a smaller, lighter battery that's also going to be less costly. So it all helps to drive down the cost of EVs going forward if you can get more efficiency.
So how does the how does the carbon sort of make the rate? Because that's the carbide, right? They're adding more carbon to the silicon.
Adding the carbon to the silicon improves the conductivity of the chips, of the transistors in the chips. So
this is less resistance then.
Basically lowering the resistance. So you're generating less heat. The electricity flows through more easily, and gets, you know, you're using the energy where it's needed in the motor, not in the power electronics.
So, and these chips are, because they're ICs, right? They're transistors.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So all they do, like a transistor, basically switches. It's like on or off.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right? So yeah.
In this case, you know, it's switching. It's doing a little more than that. You know, it's switching the current to a different direction. But yeah.
Yeah, you're right. So you've got to make the sine wave out of it versus like DC that pulses, right? So with AC, it swings. You've got your zero, which is no voltage, and it swings up for you know, to your peak, and then swings down below zero for your low peak, and it just sort of goes. That's your house current. That's why we just touch the volts.
That's what's coming out of the outlets in your house.
Yeah. So when you put your fingers on that thing, you plug the lamp in the dark. Yeah. That's why you feel a pulse.
Exactly.
That's cool.
An interesting just little tangent there. You know, if you over the years, you know, I had lots of different clock radios in the house, and they never seem to be able to hold time very well.
Yeah.
And you would think, you know, with modern, you know, especially with quartz stuff, you know, quartz clocks, you know, they're always so good at keeping time, but these cheap clock radios that you buy, they never seem to hold time very well.
Oh, the cheap ones drift a lot.
Yeah. Well, it turns out the reason why is because instead of using a quartz crystal in there, they're actually using the frequency of the alternating current to control the time. So alternating current nominally is supposed to be 60 hertz.
Yeah, that might work in Europe where their grid stays at 50, like very reliably.
Well, see, that's the problem.
Our
grid does not reliably stay at 60 hertz. So they're using that. But, you know, if your current is actually like 59 hertz or 59 and a half hertz, over time, the accuracy of your clock is going to drift. And you're going to, you know, after a few weeks, you're going to realize you're off by a couple of minutes. So just a little side note there.
No, I mean, clocks are super important. We used to have to deal with that all the time. And we still do, but it's gotten a lot easier now with all like getting video and audio, all digital systems to sync up. You know, because every digital system has its own clock reference. So if your clocks are off, things are gonna drift out of sync. So some of the studios used to use atomic clocks, and they would keep them in the oven at the studio, so a consistent temperature, because it's locked at the decay of the whatever atoms or electrons. I forget exactly what the clocks were, but there were some studios in New York that had that. They basically had like an atomic clock that they built themselves in the oven on one of the floors. It was the master sink for the whole facility, and it was just the same kind of thing. So yeah, we got a little off topic there.
Just a little.
It's been a very EV episode, but the thing that was most fascinating to me this week, I was listening to Autoline this morning, and they're sort of like daily update, and they announced the Ford Pass, and like this to me is like, here we go. It's just another step on top of the Electrify America thing, which I also think was
well, really, it's actually even more than that.
Yeah, so. No, it is. But it's like, I think with this kind of innovation, we're starting to really see this may be the tipping point where EV ownership becomes really, really practical and easy, because Ford has done what needs to be done to a large degree. They've invested big in charging network and infrastructure, and they haven't.
Actually, no, they haven't.
Well, they've assembled it. They've made an investment enough to put their name on it, to do the hard work of integrating all of it, so that you as a consumer don't have to. So that's where I'm saying, like, they've invested, like they're making it easy, so that you late adopters can get after.
They're reducing the friction for. Yes. Reducing the resistance, shall we say?
Yes, exactly.
For EV adopters.
Yeah.
So, you know, for those not familiar, Ford Pass is Ford's connectivity services platform, their connected vehicle services platform. And, you know, there's already a bunch of stuff. You know, they rebranded their telematics service last year to Ford Pass Connect. And there's the Ford Pass app that gives you access to a bunch of different things. You know, you can check your vehicle health reports and things like that. And there's various other services. But the latest thing that they're adding, soon. We're going to see it in about 3.5 weeks time, roughly. We're going to see it. And so this is the so-called Mustang inspired performance electric SUV, that's all I can tell you about it at the moment, other than that, you know, they've said it will have a 300 mile range. But the thing that they announced yesterday in conjunction with Electrify America is, you know, this charging network that what they're doing is within the Ford Pass app, they're essentially aggregating access to these different charging networks. So like today, you know, you can get the Electrify America app and you can sign up for a plan with them. You know, Electrify America's chargers are all DC fast chargers. When you use those, you know, it's actually surprisingly costly to use DC fast charging. But you can get a discount on the per minute rate. If you sign up, so if you pay, if you're going to use it on a regular basis, it's worthwhile to pay, $5 or $10, I think it is, a month. And then you get a discount on all the charging you do. Same thing goes for EVgo and ChargePoint and others. You know, they have similar plans where, you know, you pay a little bit up front and then you get a discount on everything you use after that. And so, but that requires you to use all these different apps. So depending on which charging station you go to, you got to open up the right app and make sure you have accounts with all of them and all this nonsense. What Ford is doing is they're pulling a bunch of these together into their app, into the Ford Pass app. So you'll be able to see, you know, from all these different networks, including Electrify America and Green Lots and others to be named, which one, you know, where there's a charging station of near you, you know, within range of you, whether it's available, whether there's an open plug there to plug into, and then you can go and pay for your charging right through the Ford Pass app. So you don't have to use all these numerous other apps, and you don't have to pay. You'll get the discounted rates, through the Ford Pass app. You won't have to pay the, you know, different subscription fees to all these different services.
Yeah, which is like, I think that's really key. That's important. The way you make it attractive to people is show them how easy it can be. Because like, this is, like, you've been dealing with EVs for a long time now, and like, this is not really anything terribly new. It's just kind of like repackaging. But sometimes that's really important to like you said, to reduce that friction. And so that's where I think that and the splash with Ford actually like making the announcement and putting its brand on it and its weight behind it. It's right now, and it may play out differently, but it seems like it could be a really kind of a pivotal moment where it becomes easier.
Yeah, you know, so to start with, you know, when the car launches, you know, it'll have access to more than 12,000 locations with more than 35,000 plugs to plug in. And, you know, they in the release that they put out yesterday, you know, they also revealed a couple of other tidbits about this SUV. It's going to support 150 kilowatt charging, same as the Audi e-tron and the Volvo XC40, which will give you 47 miles of range in 10 minutes. They can reconfirm that it'll have 300 mile range. And since this isn't a European car, that's what the expected range on the EPA cycle, not on the WLTP. What else? I think previously they've also said that, you know, this vehicle is going to have, it's going to have over the air update capability. So, you know, this thing's going to be available in 2020. It's being built at, Ford's Cuautitlan, Mexico plant where they have previously built the Fiesta, and they're retooling that plant right now to build this new EV.
So it's a brand new day, which just sounds like something that they would say in their marketing. But I'm curious. I'm excited. I think it's a really good move. And between Ford and GM, I almost feel like Ford has their strategy sort of a little further along, and maybe a little better worked out. But maybe that's just, you know, afterglow right now.
Well, you know, I think, you know, at the moment it looks like, you know, not rushing to be the first to market has given them an opportunity to think about, okay, what's the right kind of vehicle? What, you know, what are the specs that we need, you know, to, you know, that's going to be appealing to customers. And, you know, this thing is not going to be as affordable as, you know, say a Nissan Leaf or a Bolt or a Kia Niro EV. But, you know, they may have an easier time selling it because of the nature of the type of vehicle it is. And this is going to be, This is actually a vehicle that's going to be a very interesting competitor to the Tesla Model Y.
You think the Model Y is actually going to get here?
We'll see.
Okay, I remain skeptical.
Considering how, you know, not very different it is from the Model 3.
The other thing is, like, I kind of don't really care about the Model Y. It's a humpback Model 3.
Yeah.
Again, not to bag on Tesla. I'm just like, I like how they've pushed the market. This is because of Tesla.
Yeah, if it wasn't for Tesla, this vehicle and many others probably wouldn't exist.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, let's all just like bask in our electrified glory. I think this will be really good.
One last thing before we go, you know, while we've been recording this, something popped up in my Twitter feed. Reuters report that an electric Hummer could be part of GM's move into EV trucks.
Oh, I just saw that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Please. So, you know, yesterday, or I guess Wednesday night, GM and the UAW reached a tentative agreement for a new contract. And, you know, the union is getting ready to do the ratification votes. And part of that agreement is that GM is going to retool the Detroit Hamtramck plant to the tune of $3 billion to build an electric trucks and SUVs. And it's not quite clear, you know, what that $3 billion, you know, how much of that is for retooling. It doesn't seem like it should be that much, you know, more like maybe $1 billion to tool the plant. So they're probably including the product development costs in there. But there's been some speculation for a while that GM might revive the Hummer brand. And so, you know, there's a possibility that this electric truck could be branded as a Hummer, which would be ironic given that, you know, the Hummer, you know, before it was killed off a decade ago, you know, was sort of the anti-green vehicle. You know, it was the whipping boy for everybody promoting green transportation.
Right. Well, and Hummer just seems like kind of an odd name for an EV. Like, it's got to be whiner because the EVs whine. They don't hum. I guess they hum.
Not necessarily. You know, a lot of newer EVs, you know, have more of a hum to them than a whine. Okay. Since EVs are, you know, are going to have artificial sound now, you know, when they're driving around at lower speeds, you know, to alert pedestrians, you know, you could certainly make it hum.
That's true. I think this is a bad idea. I think it's a good way to just torch about $1 billion to establish a brand that, or like reestablish a brand, just make it a Chevy and be done with it. If you want to make an electric truck, put in your volume brand and sell as many of them as possible. Don't waste time, energy, and money getting distracted. That would be my advice to.
And you know, that's what Ford's planning to do with the F-150. So
yeah, it makes sense. You're not splitting the market that way, and you hurt yourself when you try that. It may sound good, but I think too, like, there's less of that Prius effect now than there was in the past, where you needed to have a separate, very distinct product for the electrified car. I don't think that's really the case anymore. Like, we see the same, you know, you see the BMWs that are, you know, the plug-in version of the X5 is basically the same exact thing as an X5. It's just, you know, they're sold right alongside each other, is what I'm saying. Like, and Volvo, we just talked about the XC40. So, yeah. it keeps that consistency. You know what you're getting. You just, it's like in the days of.
Yeah, I mean, Audi's using e-tron. Mercedes is using EQ for their electrified vehicles. And I think it makes sense to keep it part of the mainstream.
Yeah. So please don't do that.
Which, you having said that, means that that's exactly what they're going
to
do.
Yeah, well, they don't listen to me. They nobody has made me in charge of a car company or branding or anything or any of that. But really, I think they could have great success if they listened to all of us. You know, I think we are the sensible ones here in the industry. We get to deal with their product and try to unravel their decisions as we try to actually use the thing that they designed. So it'll all be fine. Just please just make the EVs and don't cost yourself money that you can't afford.
Yeah.
Oh, and you know, before we go, actually, I wanted to talk a little bit. I wanted to recount my experience because I dropped my Android phone and shattered the face of it, shattered the screen. And so because I find it offensive to spend too much money on phones, I cross-graded to an iPhone 8. And I was really excited. No, I wasn't. I was moderately interested in using Apple CarPlay. So I gotta say, after a little bit of trying, I don't like it. and you're on Android Auto. So is that like customizable? Can you adjust No, it's just, it is what it is.
It is what it is. Yeah. And you know, I have an older iPhone that I keep around for testing purposes, that, you know, just to try out, you know, as updates come out to Apple CarPlay, and evaluate it. And yeah, I mean, I personally prefer Android Auto to CarPlay, especially the new version of Android Auto. A few months ago, they totally revamped the interface and works a lot better now. Google's voice recognition works so much better than Siri. You know, it does what I want it to do.
Well, so that's the sort of biggest sticking point, is I don't want to deal with Siri, and you can't really get anything out of CarPlay if you don't have Siri enabled. And then when you have Siri enabled, she starts talking to you when you don't want her to talk to you. Like, I'll get a text message and it'll tell me.
Siri is verbose. And I noticed you used the term she there, which is something I've always been troubled by, referring to any of these voice assistants, you know, either as a she or he, you know, whichever voice you choose, you know, it's a program. It's an it.
Right. The choice of it being a woman's voice is this odd little bit of ingrained sexism, right? Where the woman electronic servant, or the electronic servant, is a woman. Like, doesn't that seem like that also bothers?
Or maybe it's that, you know, that they think, and we'll have to get Rebecca in on this next time. But you know, maybe I think part of it is the feeling that men are more likely to listen to a woman's voice, you know, when getting traffic directions and things like that, than another man's voice.
Isn't that the classic trope though, where the guy won't listen to his wife and won't take direction, you know, won't. Well,
but that's the thing. It's not his wife.
Oh, that's true. I don't know. I think you may be onto something.
But regardless of you know what the voice sounds like, just the idea of referring to a digital voice recognition system as he, she, or whatever, you know, it's an it. It's a program. It's an algorithm.
Yes, but we're humans. We're prone to anthropomorphize.
That's true.
We do it to our pets. We do it to our cars. Like it's just.
It's but just our pets have genders.
That's true. Our and they cars also have do personalities.
Yes.
Yeah.
But to your original point, Siri is definitely more verbose than it tries to be funny and give you some smart ass remarks sometimes, and I just find it cloying.
Yeah, I'm not that impressed. I'm disappointed that I can't make the thing do what I want the thing to do. I have to, and I can't use the phone functions if I'm on CarPlay because Siri is disabled, but I can pick up the phone and use it on it seems totally against what you would want that system to be doing. Like it's supposed to be a safety advance, but if I don't have Siri enabled, I have to pick up the phone and use the phone to dial a call, which is backwards. So I defaulted back to Bluetooth, and I can do all the things that I want to do through the infotainment system that's in the cars with Bluetooth. And it's like I can make calls, I can get to my podcast apps and stuff that way. And it's just, it's better. So.
Well, if you want Android Auto, I've still got that Nokia.
I went through the pain to transfer everything to Apple iCloud. So, I mean, I had an iCloud account, but it's just, yeah, I need to settle down. I was angry the first couple days because there's no back button. I don't like the Apple interface. There's the UI is it may have been really streamlined and refined at one point, but now there's extra wasted motion. I have to click on stuff to get the interface buttons to do the thing that I want to do where, on the Android, I had a back button. So I could.
On Android 10, the back button's gone.
Oh, is it?
But it actually, I think it actually works really well because you sweep in from the side to go back. And yeah. So it's actually easier to use it one-handed because I can do that swipe gesture with my thumb and go back instead of trying to reach across.
Maybe I'm the problem. Maybe I don't understand all the swipe gestures.
That just might be.
Yeah, it could be. Oh, well, what? We should have people weigh in on that, whether or not I'm the problem. And then we can leave the podcast at that for the week.
Let us know if Dan is the problem.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye. Talk to you next time.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.